Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Today, I'm talking with Joe Dolce, the former editor of Details Magazine and the author of the fantastic book Brave New Weed: Adventures into the Uncharted World of Cannabis. It's a richly reported and impeccably researched account of everything you could possibly want to know about medical and recreational pot. Whether you use marijuana or not, it's essential reading to understand how Americans are using drugs to improve their lives. Joe, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for calling my book fantastic.
I read a lot of books about drugs and drug policy, and this one is a real keeper. You start the book with a trip to your cousin's house that turned you onto a world that you didn't really know existed. Describe that experience for us and how it got you interested in this topic about the new world of cannabis.
Well, I certainly knew that weed existed, and I certainly used my fair share. But the last couple of years, I had really stopped. And I was visiting my cousin, and he woke me up one morning and said, "Hey, you want to see this new hobby of mine?" And he brought me downstairs into the basement and unzipped a couple of Mylar bags in which he had a couple of, he called them the girls, a couple of young cannabis plants.
And these are the girls in the basement
of your opening chapter.
Basement.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And then we start talking, and he starts showing me how he was growing them. And then he started showing me these amazing macro photographs of trichomes on leaves and all these details about the cannabis plant that I just didn't really know about. I was pretty far removed from it all. And it occurred to me that, wow, man, my cousin in rural New England has learned all this stuff about weed, mostly through the internet, guys in the local grow shop. Maybe there's something to be looking into here. Maybe there was something. This was long before Colorado and Washington and 29 states voted for, legal or medical marijuana. So it was about 5 years ago, I would say. It was happening under the surface, but it certainly wasn't happening in front of our eyes the way it is today. So that's when I started. I got interested. He gave me some of this strain, the big part of the story, called Super Lemon Haze, which is just a great strain. It's a strong sativa-dominant strain, very stimulating. And I liked it a lot. It made my mind tick along, and it didn't get me tired. And I smoked just a little, not a lot, so I didn't get paranoid. And I thought, I better get to know this plant a little better. Maybe I need to reacquaint a little bit more.
Yeah, talk about your previous experiences, because I think we're of a similar vintage. So, we would go back to a time when you were when a person was listening to a record and with a gatefold album sleeve and maybe rolling a joint there, and it was all kind of dust and dirt, seeds and stems. The world out there, even the way that you started talking about it, it's much more like wine, isn't it? Where people are picking up on different strains. And how far along are we in all of into all of that kind of boutique directed types of pot that have different effects on different types of people?
Well, we know a lot, actually. We know a whole lot. You're right. When we started smoking pot, probably in the 1970s, we were picking stems out of Pink Floyd double album covers. That's no longer the case. I mean, today, pot is a very refined plant. And it's grown with great specificity. In fact, even in Northern California now, in certain counties, they're creating a terroir system, which is exactly what they have for wine. In other words, the soil, the climate, the temperature conditions of one particular small microclimate define the territory, the terroir. And they're now bundling certain breeds that these growers in Upper Mendocino and Humboldt County have nurtured for 40, 50 years. These are heritage strains that have grown in these climate zones. So they're now, in the West Coast, you can get a specific terroir, if you will, strain of cannabis by dialing a number.
So we can, we can look forward to in 20 or 30 years, maybe movies like Bottle Shock will be reversed and it'll be French growers coming over here and winning blind taste tests over American pot or something like that.
I think things are moving so quickly it's not going to take 30 years if that's the case. As a matter of fact, I'm going to Tel Aviv tomorrow. Israel is the capital of cannabis research. And from what I understand, they're now growing, it's legal to grow and research cannabis. cannabis there, unlike the United States. So they are now growing on the tops of buildings in Tel Aviv, hydroponic gardens.
Wow. It is how are the older strains, the legendary strains of the 70s and 80s, things like Maui Wowie or Acapulco Gold, are they still in play, or have they been totally kind of superseded by new, better technologies?
No, if you can get those real strains, they're amazing. Somebody just gave me something from Thailand the other day that was just incredible. But it's hard to know what is real. That's the problem. I mean, you know, how do you really discern without genetic testing, if you will, that it really is Acapulco Gold or
right.
Maui Wowie? How do you know? A lot of people are claiming these things. Obviously, it's good branding. But it's really tough to know. You got to know your grower. That's the key. You got to know your grower and trust that he knows his strains. That's it. In a way, it's really nice. It still comes down to a personal relationship.
And now your dealer is less likely to break your kneecaps or get his kneecaps broken if he's not if everything isn't quite up to snuff or anything. And I guess part of what you talk about in the book is that, and with the terroir system and whatnot, or the appellations, controlled appellations, there are companies or people or trade associations that are coming together to kind of certify stuff. So it's like fair trade coffee or other types of products that get designated by a third party.
That's a bit in the future, but you can see it's going to come. Look, we have single estate coffees in coffee shops, right? All over the country, we have this stuff. So there's a definite market for, single malt scotch or, small brew beers and single estate coffees. We like certain part of the culture likes this sort of affinity, if you will. They have an affinity for these sorts of finer quality things. And listen, once you get a taste for it, it's sort of hard to go back, I think. And it's a really fun pursuit. It is like wine in that way. It takes a lifetime to get to know everything.
Well, and talk about how, part of what you're talking about in the book, too, is that, which I find genuinely fascinating, and it seems to completely comport with my experience and the people I talk about who are moving not just into pot, but into other types of drugs, whether they're prescription or not, but that people are not, and you yourself are not using pot necessarily to get stoned out of your mind and then, eat a bunch of Twinkies or Ding Dongs. There are ways to these drugs are being used and being kind of structured to help people with certain types of medical conditions, not to get high, but to relieve pain, to at other times to intensify sex or other activities. What is going on there, and what does it say about American society? On some level, are we growing up and recognizing that just as we have a gigantic pharmacopoeia of prescription drugs, now we're looking to kind of increase the more natural kind of drugs that are available to us?
Well, I think plant medicines have always been a part of several cultures. Our pill culture is not that old. It's about 100 years old, really. But before then, all medicines were plant-derived. Obviously, we don't trust big pharma the way perhaps we once did. Obviously, it's not all their fault that these drugs that they're pumping out and advertising on television every day are getting abused, but there's a high potential for addiction and death. Isn't it great to know that here's a plant, cannabis, that's never killed one person ever in the history of recorded time? So, and there's a reason for that. There's a real biological reason for that. We don't have the receptors that cannabis attaches to in the part of our brainstem that controls the heart and the lungs. So we are never going to shut down from over-smoking cannabis. You might get very fuzzy. You might get sort of stupid. You might pass out. You're never going to die. That's a really nice thing. And if you can harness that plant and figure out if you use this amount of this strain or this amount of this cannabinoid helps your pain, it helps your so many different illnesses of the central nervous system, the stomach, all across the body, and there's a real reason for that too. Why would you not want to do that? Why would you choose to take something that that might be damaging or deadly?
So you talk about one of the most memorable characters in the book is Dennis Perrone, the fairy godmother or fairy godfather of Pot. Explain who he is and why he is so central. And actually, before you do, let me Bigfoot you and just say, you know, one of the things that I really find great about this book is the amount of research, not even research, reporting you did. I mean, the conversations you had, the travels you did. It really brings to life a topic which oftentimes either kind of zooms off into mystical abstraction, or it's very dry and, you know, kind of rote. But talk about Dennis Perrone and the central role that he really plays in this brave new world.
So Dennis was this Vietnam vet who had come back from Vietnam, who had learned that he was gay in Vietnam, and came back and decided he was going to, you know, stop the war, stop the violence, and he was going to do it through cannabis. So he smuggled a bunch of pot back in his bag. No one was inspecting, you know, military returnees at the time. And he really did almost single-handedly sort of begin a whole weed collective in the city of San Francisco. And he started in the late 70s, kept it going through the 80s and the 90s, interestingly enough, through many arrests. And he was a real gadfly. He really liked to annoy people. Anyway, in the early 90s, he decided he was going to put a ballot initiative on the California ballot about medical marijuana. And he started, and it was a real ragtag group of volunteers, and it wasn't going quite as well as they wanted to. They were claiming they had hundreds of thousands of signatures, but in fact, most of them were sort of copied out of a phone book in alphabetical order also, so it was completely, you know, visible. And along comes a guy named Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance, who also had George Soros as one of his backers. And he saw this, and he saw an opportunity to sort of go for legal medical cannabis. And George Soros thought this was a great idea because he was very involved in the idea of death with dignity. It was a big cause of his. And he was also very against the fact that we were just arresting hundreds of thousands of black people for possession every single year, which we're still doing, by the way. Anyway, Ethan got George to pony up a bunch of money. He got George Zimmer to pony up a bunch of money. George Zimmer was the owner of Men's Warehouse. Got a few other rich folks to pony up some money, and they brought some political mavericks in and really got the number of signatures that they needed to get on the ballot for this proposition to pass. And that's what changed the game. That's what happened in 1996 in California. And that's when it became legal to use cannabis as a medicine in California. And that opened the door. That just opened the door. All the claims that it was dangerous or addictive, and you know, all the nonsense that the prohibitionists have been spewing for 80 years were pretty much, you know, obliterated in the 20 years that this program's been going on. None of this stuff has happened. None of it at all.
And it's, I mean, at this point, as you were saying, it's now at almost 30 states. About 60% of Americans are in favor of treating marijuana like beer, wine, or alcohol, which is up from about 35% just a decade or so ago.
That's right. Yeah.
By the same token, you know, it's not like things have completely changed. And there are still, as you were saying, there's still hundreds of thousands of people being locked up every year. And before we get to that kind of legal, you know, the coming legal battle, because, you know, it's still a Schedule I drug under the federal drug laws, even in other states where it's allowed. But before we get there, let's, for reasons, audience, I would love to talk about the last section of your book where you talk about the future use of pot or what's coming on. And you talk about the four enhancements that are offered to humans via marijuana consumption. Discuss those a little bit and how those figure into, you know, really the potential for marijuana to become a part of our culture that is, you know, it may never be fully accepted, but it will be more like beer, wine, and alcohol, as well as medicine. So what are the four enhancements?
Well, I mean, they're different. I mean, I think I just want to say, as we learn more about the plant, we learn how to dose it. We learn how to use it differently. We learn how to eat it differently. We learn how to vaporize it differently. So all these new things really change the game because we can use it much more precisely. We don't have to go through the same old thing. And also, you know, look, the conversation was pretty much driven by the growers. They were keeping the thing alive, and good for them. And they like to get really high. So all these things are now shifting as it becomes more of a accepted social thing, right? So I think, you know, pot definitely makes you more receptive to the world. There's no question about it to me. It opens up some doors. And that's great. It can lead you to greater intimacy, for example. It's nice to have a conversation while a little bit enhanced. It's great to have sex while a little bit enhanced. It's sort of a different experience, I think. Not what alcohol does. It's different from that. It's more of a bringing together. And I think that's great. And we've always known that it makes you open to seeing art differently, or hearing music perhaps on a different level of depth. So I think it's absolutely true that receptivity is absolutely one of the things it enhances. I think it can also be used. Some people really like it for focus. Now, there's a big bunch of coders that use cannabis when they're working. They love to write code and be high. It's hard for me as a writer to use cannabis while working. It's a real shame, but it doesn't work for me that way. You know, linear stuff doesn't work for me, but I think a lot of people get a lot of focus from using cannabis, which is very interesting. I've never really had that experience. These are the kind of things I think that we need to open ourselves to, you know, as we go forward. I mean, people who've used cannabis for years have always known these things, but I think when you think about it with intention and try to do it as such, it changes the experience. I'll say one other thing. I've met a lot of people since writing the book who use it for training, physical training, runners and certain athletes, swimmers. They really like it. Really helps them, I guess, focus, dig in a little more into the process of it. It's interesting.
Which is all also particularly fascinating, because the stereotypes and the cliches about pot users is that they're unmotivated, they're lazy, they're unfocused. And,
yeah.
You know, one of the things that is fascinating, and I suspect this feeds into a bit about the racial animus against pot and black people in the NBA. I mean, it's, you know, it's widely understood, and in the NFL as well, that athletes use pot as a way to deal with chronic pain, as well as to recover from
Absolutely.
Training and just being beaten around. And it seems odd that we wouldn't, you know, start thinking about that. You know, everybody has aches and pains, and to the extent that you can take away some of that.
They're using it. Yeah. They're just not using it publicly. I mean, CBD, which is one of the other cannabinoids, right? There's THC, which is psychoactive, CBD, which is barely psychoactive. Many people say it's not. But it's an incredible anti-pain medication. I've been using it for a little arthritis I have, and it's extraordinary because it doesn't numb you. It doesn't make you go, it doesn't fog your brain to take away the pain. It just makes the pain less there somehow. It's a very hard way to describe it. It's a different sort of pain relief than you get from the typical pain reliever that we're used to. But people in the NBA are using this. The people all over sports are using this stuff.
What will there be, and obviously there have been a number of celebrities, there have been a number of billionaires, you know, you mentioned Peter Lewis as one, you know, who talked about using pot regularly as well. You know, what is the game changer in terms of the culture? Is it more testimonies by well-regarded people, or you know, and I'm making air quotes here, but normal people who use pot, successful people who use pot, or is that what is needed to kind of convince the last 40% of Americans that prohibition is not the smartest move?
That's a great question, and I think obviously I don't know the answer, but it's happening. That's all I can say. It's happening. It's happening in the hearts and minds of lots of people. I mean, my personal prescription is to talk to people, is to, you know, I try to tell, I have no choice. I've written a book. I'm out. You know what I mean? I'm out. But,
yes.
You know, look, 420 is coming up. April 20th is big pot celebration day. You know, theatrical stuff like lighting a massive 3-foot joint on the steps of the state capitol, that's going to happen. But I think the more important thing is if you talk to a colleague or a friend who knows, maybe you know loosely, say, you know what? I really like pot. Here's how I use it. What's your experience? That seems like a small act, but let me tell you, if all the people who use cannabis were to do that to somebody they didn't know, first of all, they find out that a lot more people are using it, first of all. Secondly, they might open some hearts and minds. Thirdly, the inevitable question is, oh, can you get me something good?
It is fascinating when you talk about that. And one hopes this will have a particular effect in Washington, D.C., which the District of Columbia decriminalized pot. And now immediately there were services that crept up that sell cookies and then gift you pot when you buy cookies, and depending on what kind of cookie you get a different type of pot, and it's delivered right to your door. Yeah,
and
one would hope that that will, that the more Congress starts smoking, maybe the more they'll relax. But
talked about Donald Trump or Jeff Sessions. I mean, this
let's go there.
A whole other wrinkle in the picture here. So who knows what they're going to do? These guys, they're so impenetrable. But I don't think Trump has a big issue with weed. I mean, he has said in the past that he knows people who use it. It's no big deal. Okay. Then he appoints this guy like Jeff Beauregard Sessions, who's, a pretty law and order type of guy. And he has never said a nice thing about cannabis. He thinks people who use cannabis are, quote, bad guys, which is, half the American population. Okay. But there he is. And he can do some insidious things. I mean, he could do big scale stuff. I don't particularly think that's going to happen, but I do think they'll be targeting some people who are breaking the laws or who are loose with the laws in Colorado and California. They're going to make some big busts. They're going to send some tremors through the industry. I predict that will happen based on absolutely no evidence whatsoever. It just seems like an obvious thing to do. The guy's going to want to flex his muscles. Trump's all about law and order. Pot's always been one of the first things you can crack down on with law and order. Why? Because it's big and it stinks, so it's easy to catch. It's just that's what history in America has done, and I don't think these guys are original enough to recreate a great idea. I think they're just going to copy an old idea, basically. So I think there will be some pushback, but I do think that it's going to be awfully hard to shut down at this point. Don't you?
Well, this is I agree. Although this is, I've been lately thinking about the novel All Quiet on the Western Front, where the narrator, or rather the protagonist, dies after the armistice is signed. I think in many ways that the pro-pot forces have won the war, but there's still a kind of surrender to be signed, and a lot of damage can be done in the meantime.
That's exactly right.
It may be fascinating also to see that somebody like Jeff Sessions, who as a senator from Alabama was always talking a lot about federalism and returning control to the states, it will be ironic if his moves state like Colorado.
The Republicans use that when they're not in power, and the Democrats use it when they're not in power.
Saying the irony of somebody like Governor Hickenlooper in Colorado, who was originally against legalization, a Democrat, but is now saying I got to admit, it's working out pretty well.
$134 million extra in taxes in his state. Yeah, I think he's pretty happy. No increase in crime, no increase in drunk driving or whatever driving you call it. No major problem at all, and huge tax revenue, and the tourism in Colorado is through the roof. Arthur Frommer, who's about 89, the father of the godfather of American travel. He said that Canada tourism is going to be the next biggest boom in American tourism.
So it's going to be something like Colorado on 5 grams a day or something like that?
Yeah, why not? I mean, what a beautiful place to go and use cannabis. What a great idea, by the way.
So John Denver was way ahead of the his time, right?
We were all there.
Do you As a final question, do you think, and this may be way premature, but will kind of the cannabis revolution, because again, what your book is about is, and I don't actually want to diminish at all the simple pleasure and the infinite pleasure of getting high and just kind of checking out for a while. But your book is actually, it talks about that, but then it talks about all these other uses of pot. We seem to be in a stage now where we're reading more and more reports about, Wall Street bankers microdosing with LSD or psilocybin and other drugs. There is serious groups like MAPS are trying to do serious research about psychedelics and other types of drugs. Do you think we're entering into a new phase where, and maybe it took us 100 years to get used to pills, and then going back to something that is even more wide-ranging than getting prescribed?
There's huge, huge movement into psychedelics. I don't think pills and pharmacology is the same thing. I mean, we're looking at shifting human consciousness and playing with that and toying with that. There's always been interests in that. And look, we're a secular society, despite what they say. So the experience of the divine is far less available to us than it once was hundreds of years ago. So it seems to make sense that we are a society also that is very chemically astute. We are a technical society, and that some of these incredible pharmaceuticals, LSD I'm thinking about, but also things that are grown, psilocybin and ayahuasca, we all know people who are experimenting with these substances, and a wide range of people and a vast variety of professions and socioeconomics. You know, it really cuts across society. People are interested in exploring the limits of human consciousness, I think, and they want to scratch the surface. And frankly, that the U.S. government or any government should say you are not allowed to do that is, you know, it's indefensible. It's intellectually preposterous. It's against every supposed right we have. Think about it.
And it's increasingly difficult to police because
you cannot police it.
Yeah.
It
brings us back to your cousin's basement. Right, where it's exactly. It's happening all around us, whether you want it or not. So, we will leave it there. Joe Dolce, the author of Brave New Weed: Adventures into the Uncharted World of Cannabis. Thanks so much for talking to us and expanding our consciousness a little bit.
My pleasure. I'm going to start a podcast under the name of Brave New Weed next month, Nick. So people can maybe check that out if they're interested. Also, looking again at the future of the post-prohibition world.
That sounds fantastic. It'll be, it'll be a wonderful window onto what is possible and how we can get there faster. Thanks so much.
I hope so. Thank you so much for your time.
This has been The Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and never miss an episode.